What I am going to talk about tonight results from a project that was conducted within the framework of the Heidelberg University's Cluster of Excellence from the end of 2012 to summer 2016. As it had a transcultural and interdisciplinary scope, the sources, the so-called Greek and Demotic magical papyri, were treated in close cooperation by an Egyptologist, me, and a Greek philologist and papyrologist, my colleague Dr. Lyuba Bortolani. The leaders of this project were Professor of Egyptology Joachim Friedrich Quack and Professor of Classics William Furley, who both contributed with editions of hitherto unpublished magical papyri. Currently, the four of us have started to follow up with a new DFG project on the erotic spells contained in the same corpus of magical handbooks. The text of your handout is just one example of a spell, of a group of spells of which I will talk later. You don't need it now, it's more so that you have one example of a spell in your hand, and I will refer to some of the things in this text later, but not right now. In order to present to you an overview of the divination techniques in the magical papyri and some more detailed results from my part of the research, I would like to first give an introduction to the character of the sources that we deal with and their religious historical context. Our core material are the so-called Greek and Demotic magical papyri from Roman and Byzantine Egypt. Following the first collective edition of the Greek spells by the Heidelberg classicist Karl Preisendanz in 1928-31 and the comprehensive English translation of the Greek and Demotic texts under the leadership of Hans-Dietrich Betz in 1986, the translation on your handout is from this very publication. They are usually abbreviated as PGM for Papyri Graecae Magicae and PDM, respectively. Demotic is the name of a late stage of the Egyptian language, as well as for the cursive script that is usually, but not always, used to write texts in this very language phase. And it precedes the Coptic language phase and script. Demotic was in use from circa the 7th century BC until the very latest attestations in the middle of the 5th century AD. Just to show you the demotic parts of this bilingual papyrus, these are demotic columns, and you can see here that other columns and parts of the text are written in Greek script. Before talking about these sources in more detail, I want to quickly call the historical key dates to mind. After the victory of Octavianus, the later Emperor Augustus, against Mark Antony and the famous Ptolemaic Queen Cleopatra, Egypt became a Roman province in 30 BC and was henceforth ruled by the Roman emperors, represented by a prefect governor of Egypt. When the empire was divided in 395 AD, Egypt fell to the Eastern Roman Empire and was ruled from Constantinople. However, the ongoing cultural and religious developments of the now Christianized country continued until the Arab conquest in 642. This setting is particularly interesting for the study of transcultural dynamics, since even before the Roman conquest of Egypt, the country had already undergone two Persian conquests and subsequent rules in the 6th and 4th centuries BC, and especially the about 300 years of Greek rule under the Ptolemies, which followed the conquest of Egypt by Alexander the Great in 332 BC. In Roman Egypt, the dominant cultural tradition was actually still Greek and not Roman. Despite the political and social changes, the Greek administrative elite was kept in place, exactly as Greek language was kept as a language of administration, while Roman penetration of Egypt remained relatively scant. With most of the Greek and Demotic magical papyri dating to the 2nd until the 5th century AD, this corpus testifies vividly to the very hybrid society of this era and its even more complex religious life. The main cultural groups were Egyptians and Greeks, while Romans were mostly present in the military sector. Furthermore, there were also large Jewish communities in some places, for instance in Alexandria and Elephantine. and the rising Christian religion first existed next to pagan traditions and then slowly replaced them. There are, however, a few papyri of the corpus with a somewhat earlier date, especially several unpublished and fragmentary papyri with precursors of these types of magical spells in Egyptian language and script, dating back to Ptolemaic and even earlier date, up to the 6th century BC. These fragments are currently being edited by our project member, Professor Joachim Quack. Also, literary sources attest to the existence of magical handbooks in earlier periods, and not only in Egypt, but also in other parts of the Mediterranean world. For example, Suetonius writes that Emperor Augustus ordered the burning of 2,000 magical scrolls in the year 13 BC. Especially in late antiquity, proscriptions against magical practices, including divination, were issued repeatedly and led to the increasing necessity of keeping the manuscripts and connected activities secret, even though some of them would not have necessarily been considered illegal in earlier Egyptian history. This is, for instance, true for divinatory practices, for which we have an edict prohibiting them from 199 AD. I quote, "Since I have come across many people who consider themselves to be beguiled by the means of divination, I quickly considered it necessary, in order that no danger would ensue upon their foolishness, clearly herein to enjoin all people to abstain from this hazardous superstition. Therefore, let no man, through oracles, that is, by means of written documents, supposedly granted in the presence of the deity, nor by means of the procession of cult images or such like charlatanry, pretend to have knowledge of the supernatural, or profess to know the obscurity of future events, nor let any man put himself at the disposal of those who inquire about this, nor answer in any way whatsoever. If any person is detected adhering to this profession, let him be sure that he will be handed over for capital punishment." Still, there are papyri. Up to now, the corpus of magical texts from Roman Egypt consists of about 240 papyri of different length, and in addition, about 40 other documents on ostraca, wooden and metal tablets, the so-called tabellae de fictionum, that contain ritual spells for personal purposes. The numbers of sources are continually growing, since further texts are awaiting publication. The documents contain, on the one hand, huge manuals with extensive collections of spells for different purposes, such as this one, but on the other hand, single techniques and remains of actually performed individual rituals, for instance, incantations or curses that had to be written down in the course of the procedures. This group of sources is conventionally called applied magic. Apart from objects inscribed with texts, we also need to consider little figurines, magical gems with engravings, and other objects produced during magical rituals. For the subgroup of divination rituals, however, there are practically no clearly recognizable remains of applied magic or personalized spells in the archaeological record due to the nature of these rituals. One problem of research, though at the same time a lucky incident in itself, is the fact that the great bulk of the really extensive Demotic and Greek handbooks stems from only one archaeological context, somewhere on the west bank of ancient Thebes, that is modern Luxor, where they had been deposited in late antiquity together with Coptic magical texts and Gnostic and alchemical treatises. Since they have been found by local Egyptians in the 19th century and were subsequently sold in Thebes to a European collector, Jean d'Anastasie, the exact fine spot and context, however, are not documented. But this group is therefore usually referred to as Theban Magical Library or Anastasie Papyri. Most of the preserved texts are written in Greek script and language, but to a smaller extent also in Egyptian, more specifically Demotic. Smaller parts, especially within the recitation sections and supralinear glosses, appear furthermore in the older Egyptian cursive script called hieratic, or in Egyptian language written in Greek alphabet, the so-called Old Coptic script, as the detail on the slide shows. Here we have Demotic script, but it is a special kind of demotic script devised only for magical names. It's a kind of alphabetic demotic script, and in superscript between the lines we have the same names rendered with Greek letters. But this doesn't mean that they represent Greek language, they are just renderings of different kinds of words in Greek letters. Some papyrus manuals are even bilingual in themselves, as the one on the slide, insofar as they contain demotic as well as Greek sections and complete spells. A special feature of the magical papyri, as well as of other magical texts and objects in the Mediterranean world, are the so-called vocis magicae, magical words often used as names or epithets of the invoked deities. These are the ones that are usually written in these special scripts. And in the text on your handout, you find them, these vocis magicae, they are usually written in capitals in the translations. They mostly seem to go back to divine names, attributes, and religious formulas from various languages and cultural contexts that have been transcribed phonetically into another script and language. With time and through the ongoing copying process, these words become more and more distorted, sometimes to such a degree that the original form as well as meaning cannot even be deducted anymore by modern researchers, although many try to do this. And we have to assume that they were in most cases also already lost to the antique users of the spells, who might have just perceived them as powerful and foreign, or part of a specific magical language. Apart from the already mentioned scripts, languages, and magical words, the texts also feature magical signs of mostly unknown meaning, and sometimes drawings of deities, demons, angels, symbols, etc. So these texts are very interesting to look at, even, and they have a lot of different elements contained in them. Corresponding to the interesting mixture of languages and script, the religious contents of the spell also reflect an intense cultural interaction between Egyptian, Greek, and Jewish, as well as to a lesser extent Mesopotamian and early Christian traditions. This means that deities and ritual elements of various origins can appear side by side in a single spell, and in some of them we can observe even an actual fusion of these different traditions. The preserved handbook versions, dating mostly to late antiquity, are actually the products of a long process of collection, reworking, and editing of earlier material. This process and some of its stages can still be glimpsed within the extant texts, for example, through reductional comments by scribes, references to different sources, etc. But also when we conduct a close textual analysis in the course of our research. This means comparing parallel or similar spells and recitations with each other and tracing the textual traditions of Egyptian as well as Greek rituals and religious hymns. These hints from intra and extra textual analysis show that the handbooks themselves and the rituals contained in them have been used and actively modified over longer periods of time. And we only have a relatively late end product of this process here. In spite of the multicultural influences that are apparent, several scholars have already demonstrated that much of the material, as well as the actual compilation activity, can be traced back to the Egyptian priestly milieu. The Egyptian priests seem to have been adapting their traditional material, that means ritual techniques, hymns, invocations of deities, and other religious texts, to the needs of magicians or ritual experts and clients from the mixed population. Obviously triggered by the already existing Greek and Roman discourse on Egyptian mysteries and specific magical powers, as well as by the growing exchange of knowledge and religious practices, especially in Hellenized centers such as Alexandria, a new market for Greco-Egyptian spells of various types developed progressively. The general characteristic is the rather private nature of these rituals, which sets them into contrast to other magical rituals that were traditionally used in the official temple cult in order to take care of matters of state, God's nature, and the balance of the world, even though partly deriving exactly from the ritual practices of this official temple cult, the spells are trimmed in such a way as to deal with more personal problems and in general aimed at gaining a certain control over the natural insecurities of personal life. The Christian apologetic Anobius gives a nice summary of the different objectives of ancient magic. For who is not aware that these men either study to know beforehand things impending, which, whether they will or not, come of necessity as they have been ordained, or to inflict a deadly and wasting disease on whom they choose, or to sever the affections of relatives, or to open without keys places which are locked, or to seal the mouth in silence, or in the chariot race to weaken, urge on, or retard horses, or to inspire in wives and the children of strangers, whether they be males or females, the flames and mad desires of illicit love, or if they seem to attempt anything useful, to be able to do it not by their own power, but by the might of those deities whom they invoke. These different objectives correspond with different spell types or genres contained in the magical papyri. Their aims are to improve issues of health, love and sexuality, to obtain knowledge of the future, power and success in various areas of life, and in the negative, the downfall of rivals and enemies. Divination rituals actually constitute one of the two largest groups of genres, or genres of spells, within the magical papyri, with circa 140 single spells. The other big category being erotic spells, the object of our second project. Under the superordinate term divination rituals, we count all the different techniques that are employed to establish a contact with the divine or supernatural world for the purpose of gaining any kind of knowledge, decision help, or mystical power, whether from a god or other supernatural beings. As far as I could gather from the homepage of the Erlangen Research Consortium, your projects on fate, freedom and prognostication are mainly concerned with East Asia and medieval Europe. So I would like to include a few general notes about what exactly was divination in antiquity and how it worked, even though there will probably be many overlaps with your fields of research, so I hope this will not be too boring. The word divination derives from the Latin divinatio and the verb divinare, which means to prophesy or even to guess, but actually goes back to the root divus, divine, so the literal meaning would be doing the divine. This includes the interpretation of signs in nature, also called omina. However, in that case, the gods are only indirectly involved, because the signs were considered to have been sent by them, usually unprovoked by human agency, and the deities did not need to appear or speak themselves. Men are only passive receivers and interpreters of these natural signs. In contrast, oracles were actively sought by people, usually in order to receive answers for specific questions directly from the god or higher being. Although this classification is a modern one, ancient authors thought about the different methods of divination and their merits as well. Philosophical considerations, criticism, and disbelief didn't lack either. The Roman politician and advocate Cicero even wrote a whole book about it and differentiated between natural and technical divination, the first comprising phenomena like dreams and ecstatic trances, the second one professional techniques like reading animal livers or observing the flight of birds, which were performed by learned experts in official Roman religion. In our modern research on divination in antiquity, we often distinguish between two further categories, deductive and inspired divination. The first encompasses practices that make only a very indirect perceived contact, if any, with the divine world, as no appearance by a higher being is necessary. They gain their answers or results from encrypted signs or, again, natural omina that have to be read and interpreted in some way. Usually, the result is given from prefabricated answers, one of which is chosen through some kind of randomizing process that depends on pure luck, for instance, sortition and dice oracles. When looking at the respective sources, these techniques often come with a kind of list or handbook in which the interpretations or answers can be looked up. In contrast, inspired divination includes a more or less direct manifestation of the deity or other supernatural being who communicates with the diviner or medium. Some scholars prefer to call the techniques involving such a divine encounter rituals of apparition instead of divination rituals. The divination spells in the magical papyri mainly contain relatively complex rituals belonging to the category of inspired divination, but there are also some examples of deductive divination. A sortition oracle using verses from Homer, another one using letters of the alphabet, a numerical table with which a prognosis about the survival of a sick person can be made by combining certain numbers, a dice oracle, and one using either knuckle bones or, again, dice. This is a fragmentary text, so it's not quite certain, as well as horoscopes and hemerologies. The latter, however, mainly with the specific goal of telling propitious days for divination and magical rituals. Another group whose structure deviates a bit from the aforesaid typology of divination rituals are charms that provide the user with general knowledge or foreknowledge and can demand a divine omen as affirmation in advance. Relatively common is furthermore the special group of spells for finding thieves that work by a mechanism that somehow forces the thief to confess or reveal himself. While knowledge spells show a certain resemblance to so-called charitesia, that is spells for personal charisma, power, success, and the like, the thief spells could be understood as related to curses or constraining spells. So these groups are on the borderline between divination and other magical practices. Our work, however, concentrates specifically on the branch of inspired divination. In Egypt and Greece, the main contributing cultures to the magical papyri, oracles had a very long tradition and were usually conducted in the environment of sanctuaries and under the direction of professional priests. However, in Roman Egypt, the successive legal prohibitions, together with the gradual recession of the temple's power, seem to have led to increased private use of such rituals that were adapted for performance at home or by various religious specialists who offered their services to customers. Thus, in the extant magical handbooks, we find a very developed form of divination rituals, which have been copied and edited several times. Their core usually goes back to ancient, more official ritual practices of different origin, but with time they have been supplemented by diverse elements taken from other cultural traditions or current religious and philosophical discourses even. In fact, some of these rituals contained in the handbooks in a way seem to be not only simply concerned with solving an immediate problem or gaining knowledge about some aspect of one's future personal life, but sought a more permanent mystical union with a deity in order to gain universal knowledge and or power and a deeper understanding of the divine. Therefore, some of these rituals, especially very extensive and complex ones, have also been labeled initiation rituals, comparable to the initiation into mystery cults, or counted among the practice of theurgy by modern researchers, because they partly overlap with those theories and practices described and discussed under this term in the Chaldean oracles and by Neoplatonists. The final goal of theurgy was nothing less than the salvation of the soul from the physical world and its union with the divine or spiritual world. The two spells that are especially concerned is the so-called Mithras liturgy and a handbook entitled The Eighth Book of Moses. The Mithras liturgy encompasses a heavenly ascent of the practitioner or his soul through various celestial spheres and their occupants, that is, celestial bodies and deities, with which he then unites. On the slide you see an excerpt from this text describing part of this heavenly ascent. The introduction to the spell claims that the aim of the ritual is so that I alone may ascend into heaven as an inquirer and behold the universe. A part of the procedure is even called immortalization, and the keyword immortality is being dropped several times during the various stages of this ritual. However, in spite of the very mystical sounding main parts of the ritual, the much more pragmatically styled final parts of the text are again more similar to many other examples of normal divination spells, as they describe, for example, the standard and very concrete outcome of a divination practice, the utterance of an oracle by the god. This example demonstrates, on the one hand, that within the corpus of magical texts, a mystical union with a deity is often not a final goal in itself, but rather just a preparatory step or precondition in order to be able to communicate with the deity at all and finally receive an oracle. On the other hand, it shows that when dealing with the actual textual sources, it is often difficult to categorize them precisely or to make clear distinctions between various practices. With such difficulties kept in mind, the divination spells of the Greek and Demotic magical papyri can still be roughly subdivided according to the different ritual techniques and the central medium used to produce the intended contact with the divine. I will now give a short overview of what these techniques and their typical characteristics are. First, the direct vision. The practitioner aims at a personal meeting with the deity in a vision that is achieved without the help of a material medium or dream, by means of which the higher being manifests itself. Instead, the spells either describe a direct arrival of the deity before the practitioner's eyes, or even an ascent to heaven by the practitioner himself, as in the Mithras liturgy. Therefore, it was considered the most difficult and advanced form of divination. For its achievement, a very thorough preparation and intense concentration are indispensable. Several of the pertaining spells give very lengthy and complicated instructions for this kind of ritual, including, for instance, breathing and speaking techniques for different vocal effects that might be intended to produce a state of trance. To our knowledge, this subcategory is only attested by Greek spells, which on the other hand does not at all mean that the contents are exclusively of Greek origin. A special subgroup are the extensive initiatory rituals that I already described. The main deity supposed to appear in direct visions is usually a high heavenly god such as Apollo or the sun god, who has usually strongly Egyptian character in these texts. The next category is the dream oracle. In contrast to the direct vision, the practice of requesting the god to give an oracle in a dream is probably the most common form of divination in Greco-Roman Egypt. However, there are a lot of varying methods to produce such a divine dream, which makes the subcategory a very heterogeneous one. Usually, the practitioner has to conduct a sequence of rituals and invocations before lying down to sleep. In many cases, he is advised not to speak to anyone before sleeping. The sleeping place and or the sleeper himself are required to fulfill certain conditions. For example, the practitioner has to sleep on a pure reed mat. And they are equipped with magical materials, objects or written incantations to draw the deity to the sleeper. Images of the invoked deity that are held by the sleeper or placed close to him, usually at its head or around his head, also work to his advantage. In various cases, lamps are lighted and sometimes addressed with invocations before lying down. Spells for inducing a dream oracle are to a certain degree interrelated with spells for sending dreams to another person. However, this last category usually aims at manipulating the receiver by false dreams, for example, in the context of a love spell. And therefore, it belongs to the greater category of binding or damaging spells, so-called black magic. Therefore, they do not really belong to divination rituals. Bowl divination and lamp divination. A great number of spells, especially but not exclusively in the Demotic manuscripts, concern practices in which the deity or demon is invoked to appear by means of either a bowl or a lamp. These techniques are closely related, especially as both objects have to be filled with a liquid. Oil in case of the lamp, mixed with water, oil mixed with water in case of the bowl. To create a vision and see an appearance by the gods, the practitioner usually has to look into the reflecting liquid surface of the bowl or into the flickering light of the flame. In contrast to dream oracles, in which a lamp is also sometimes used, in proper lignomancy rituals, the deity is supposed to appear directly in or around the flame of the lamp, and similarly in lignomancy, in or through the liquid of the bowl. Often a sequence of closing and opening the eyes, accompanied by recitations, is prescribed to provoke the visual effects. In the core ritual of lamp divination, the lamp is usually the only source of light in an otherwise dark room. In contrast, bowl divination does not necessarily take place in a room, but there are both rituals to be performed outside, more concretely on the roof or in an elevated place, and directed to celestial bodies, and rituals to be practiced closer to the ground and inside a room. Accordingly, either the sun, the full moon, or again a lamp can be employed to throw light on the surface of the liquid and possibly create reflections. Comparable with the lignomancy rituals that take place outside and address celestial bodies, there is also a very small group of spells that can be subsumed under the term sunlight divination and seem to be interrelated with lamp divination. Both groups use the light as central medium for the god, and the practitioner or a boy medium usually has to stare into it. A common device of lamp and bowl divination, but even more frequent in the latter, is eye ointment or eye paint, consisting of vegetable, mineral, and animal substances. Despite several similarities and even some shared recitation parts, it is noticeable that lamp divination is in most cases directed to a solar deity, whereas during bowl divination, tonic deities and spirits are invoked in many cases, and even a certain overlap with necromantic procedures can be observed. I will come back later to the lamp divination rituals and give some examples. Many spells for the practices already presented, except for dream oracles, are not only intended to be used by the magician alone, but prescribe at least the possibility of using another person as medium. In most cases, this person explicitly has to be a child, usually a boy before sexual maturity. The boy often had to be clad in linen, a material which was considered pure and appropriate for the contact with deities. He is usually sitting, kneeling, or lying in front of the magician, who has to recite magical formulas into his ears to put him into a trance. Sometimes the practitioner also touches the boy's head with a finger. The child's status and ability to see the gods can be put to a test beforehand by asking specific questions that are provided in some of these spells. The frequent use of amulets and prayers for the children's safety and fearlessness demonstrates that in reality the children could be weak and disoriented, maybe even psychotic after experiencing such a ritual. Actually, we have to differentiate between two distinct ways of using a child or even adult medium for divination. Either the medium just sees or hears the higher being in a vision or material medium and talks to it in the same way the magician himself would do if he did the ritual on his own, or the medium himself is possessed by the deity, which means that the deity or demon manifests inside the medium. However, there's actually only one unambiguous spell of this possessed type included in the magical handbooks, entitled Solomon's Collapse. The other subcategories we developed to arrange the remaining spells dealing with divination are less obvious and more problematic. For instance, within the magical manuscripts, there's quite a great number of spells that can be used or adapted for multiple purposes, among them often also divination. One interesting subgroup of them is necromancy, for which the spirit of a dead person is acquired as a responding being, medium, or servant, usually by taking and conjuring a piece of the corpse from its tomb or clothing. spirits of the dead can also be invoked in the course of other divination practices, so it is not necessarily a category of its own. And as mentioned before, there's especially a certain overlap with bowl divination, in which the ritual may sometimes be addressed to spirits of the dead. Then there are also some unspecified divination rituals, often only consisting of invocations to a deity to prophesy. The exact ritual and medium of the deity's manifestation remain, however, obscure. These spells might also be incomplete in some cases. Finally, there is a group of spells that does not provide prescriptions for a divination ritual proper, but rather additional information and utilities for such. For instance, the already mentioned hemerologies and horoscopes, telling propitious days and hours for divination, or memory spells helping to remember the contents of a vision, as well as recipes for eye ointments. These auxiliary spells appear sometimes separately, but can also be integrated as a part of a more detailed divination spell. How are the divination spells organized and structured in their written form within the magical handbooks? Since most of the preserved handbooks were probably copied from assemblages of earlier, smaller collections of spells, the order of single spells can sometimes seem somewhat chaotic, or the ordering principles were different from what a modern reader would expect. For instance, spells are sometimes not grouped together by their aim, but rather by other common elements in their procedure, such as, for example, the use of inscribed stones, etc. Still, in some cases, we can also recognize sequences of spells belonging to common thematic groups like divination or love magic. For example, in the very long Demotic Handbook, PDM 14, or better known as Papyrus Magical London Leiden. Throughout this papyrus, three such pure clusters of divination spells can be observed on the rectal side. They contain especially various recipes for bowl and lamp divination, but also, to a smaller number, sunlight divination and dream oracles. The first cluster encompasses columns 1 to 10 of this papyrus and is occupied by the largest group of divination spells, with mainly long instructions for basic techniques, including a lot of details. The second group, in columns 16 to 18, has mainly lamp divination and one bowl divination spell, with many alternatives, but the rituals are described in much less details than the group one. The third group in columns 27 to 29 is a mixed group with shorter spells, including one nearly exact duplicate of a lamp divination spell in group one, and one nearly exact duplicate of one bowl divination spell as well. The many parallels between the different groups support the theory that these three groups represent three master copies with spells in different states of development, from which the scribe of this Leiden papyrus copied. Although there is not exactly a common formal scheme to all the extant spells, they are at least made up of the two elementary components of basically every magical ritual put down in writing in these handbooks, namely ritual instructions or the praxis, and recitations or the logos, in various numbers and order. These basics are sometimes supplemented by additional comments by the author or compiler that are neither instructions nor recitations, but for instance quality ratings, additional information and references, special emphasis or explanations on single aspects or effects of the ritual. The arrangement of the instruction and recitation sections differs substantially from spell to spell, and unfortunately it does in many cases not correspond with the supposed actual course of the ritual, which means that sometimes it is quite difficult to reconstruct the sequence of actions and invocations in the way they were meant to be conducted. This is, of course, exactly what we try to do in order to understand the exact structure, not only of the manuals, but also of the supposed enacted rituals themselves. In the final part of this lecture, I would like to present one of the divination techniques in a little more detail, and demonstrate the relationships between the attested spells, their cultural backgrounds, what kind of sources they draw from, and how certain elements are adapted over time. For this purpose, I chose the technique of divination with lamps, because it was next to bowl divination the main focus of my part of the project, and it is a little more homogeneous than some of the other practices. All in all, there are 13 extant spells in which the invoked god is certainly supposed to appear directly by means of the flame of the lamp, plus one dream oracle spell where a short section describes a lamp divination as an alternative option. And two very short auxiliary spells for eye ointments. A very recent addition to the corpus are the fragmentary remains of a demotic magical handbook, identified by Joachim Friedrich Quack and currently in preparation for an edition by him. The differing provenance, Tepchinus in the Fayum instead of Thebes, and a slightly earlier date, the 1st to 2nd century, set it a little bit apart from the other attestations, which date to the 2nd to 4th or 5th century, and make it especially interesting for the analysis of this ritual technique's development in Egypt. Otherwise, all extant demotic lignomancy spells are concentrated on the extensive handbook of London Leiden, exclusively, where they appear in all three of the aforementioned clusters of divination spells, plus one unconnected spell. Moreover, these recipes are strongly interrelated with each other and can probably be traced back to only one basic technique, which was expanded into several alternative details and variations. In contrast, within the Greek magical handbooks, only four real lignomancy spells are scattered over the four manuscripts, PGM 1, 2, 4, and 7, plus one lignomancy alternative to a dream oracle spell in PGM 8. The rituals of PGM 1 and 2 can be considered as related, but the other three are quite diverging in ritual details. Basically, the extant lamp divination spells belong to two different groups, one with a more Egyptian tradition, the other with a strong Greek and more specifically Apollonian background, with roots in the official divination procedures of famous Apollo sanctuaries. The spells of each group share a lot of common elements among each other. All the demotic spells belong to the first group, but also, the Greek language spells of PGM 4, 7, as well as the alternative option of PGM 8 can be counted among this Egyptian type of rituals. The second group consists only of the two Greek spells in PGM 1 and 2. The most extensive and detailed ritual instruction for the Egyptian type is the long spell covering the columns 6 to 8 of the London Leiden Magical Papyrus, containing a lot of elements that reappear in the other spells and giving several alternatives for single aspects of the ritual. Furthermore, the contents, script, and language of this spell show in some sections certain chronologically older characteristics, pointing to an earlier date of composition than other parts of this manuscript. For instance, the frequent use of outdated words and grammatical structures, as well as of the older hieratic Egyptian script. Here's an excerpt of the central ritual instructions from this very spell. Words in italics represent words written in the older hieratic script in the original texts, and bold type represents red ink in the original text. The core ritual generally takes place in a room in which the lamp is set up. The exact setting and configuration of the lamp is usually described in great detail, since it is the medium of divine apparition and thus constitutes the most important part of the ritual. In three spells of the Long Demotic Handbook of London Leiden, the wick of the lamp is to be inscribed with an identical short series of magical signs, obviously derived from Egyptian hieroglyphs, and with the magical name Bahuch Sihuch, rendering the Egyptian epithet Soul of Darkness, Son of Darkness in Greek letters. At least the first half, Soul of Darkness, is also used several times in the slightly varied form Ba in Hoch, as a name for the invoked deity in the related Greek language lamp divination spells of PGM4. This is the one on your handout, and I have marked the magical word, and also in PGM7. Both variations probably attest to a common tradition of addressing the soul of the primeval darkness during lamp divination, especially since various allusions to the relationship between light and darkness form a central element of the ritual as well as the recitations of this technique. Actually, already in the earlier fragmentary demotic spell from Tepchinus, souls of darkness, here in the plural, are requested to be sent, and the expression is written unetymologically even here. In most cases of the Egyptian type ritual, a child is used as a medium, but sometimes the magician can also conduct the ritual alone and thereby see the gods himself. The appearance of a deity or demon is usually produced by a sequence of closing and opening the eyes to look at the lamp, while reciting to the lamp, and if a boy medium is used, reciting to the boy. In many cases, a first recitation before the actual ritual starts is addressed to the sun god in the morning to gain his support and thereby guarantee the success of the procedure. In the long and chronologically older Egyptian spell, this recitation to the sun god is quoted by title only. You recite the spells of praising Ra at dawn when he rises. This title points to a specific kind of text or text genre which had to be well known by the Egyptian practitioner, since the text itself is not given here. The greeting of the sun god in the morning in the form of a hymn or litany had a long tradition in Egyptian religion, and the quoted title is actually very similar to titles of ritual books that are known from Egyptian sources. In fact, a huge amount of attestation for the praise of the sun god in the morning originates from Thebes, just like the magical handbooks themselves. The other demotic examples, all from cluster 2 in the London Leiden Papyrus, however, fill in some already adapted and changed material here. A prayer is actually quoted, but it consists of little more than vocis magicae. Also, in the Greek lamp divination spell of PGM4 on your handout, this prayer has been adapted and was called encounter or communication with the god, to be recited first toward the sunrise and a second time to the lamp itself. In this case, the full text of a prayer is given, and it is not an Egyptian sun litany, but a short Greek hexametrical hymn, adapting a line of Homer's Odyssey, but at the same time reflecting Egyptian concepts of the sun god, mixed with a few vocis magicae in the end. The instruction in the Greek spell that the same hymn has to be recited again to the lamp underlines the imagined direct connection between sunlight and lamplight, as it is also explained by the Roman author and philosopher Apuleius. In a scene of his romance, Metamorphoses, in which tales of witches and miracles abound, he says, "There's nothing strange, that small flame made by human hands. However, the memory of that greater and heavenly fire, as if of its parent, can in measure both know by divine foreknowledge and announce to us what will be produced in the firmament above." The Greek or Apollonian type of the extant lamp divination rituals also uses the lamp to make the deity appear in or around it, but it does not seem to be the only central element. In both spells of this group, Apollo is addressed as main deity with Greek hexametrical hymns, and accordingly, laurel, sprigs, and leaves are used to influence him, because laurel was considered his sacred plant and also played a role in the cult and oracle practice of Greek Apollo sanctuaries. In the two lamp divination rituals, the laurel leaves are supposed to be inscribed with magical names or characters. In the course of the ritual, a throne and a couch or footstool are set up and covered with linen, probably to receive the appearance of the god. Quite in contrast to the Egyptian type, the Greek type spells make a point of prescribing detailed food offerings, libations, and burnt offerings for the deity. Apart from the core ritual, there are three features of the Greek type which are furthermore shared by the Greek language spell of PGM4 and contribute to the theory that although the ritual of the latter spell generally belongs to the Egyptian ritual type group, it shows some distinct revisions making it more usable for a Greek audience, or more generally for people outside the Egyptian priestly tradition. The first feature concerns the preparations and attire of the magician. The spells give directives to refrain from unclean things, fish and sexual intercourse, and to wear a prophetic garment, which is sometimes even described in greater detail. Although the cultural origins of these standards lie in the Egyptian priesthood, the explicit instruction obviously makes more sense for users outside the Egyptian priestly milieu, whose members would have naturally known this code by heart. The second element is a phylactery, that is some kind of amulet that protects the practitioner or the medium from the dangerous presence and powers of the deity. Although among the lamp divination spells only shared by the one in PGM 1 and 4, this is generally a typical device of Greek language divination rituals, but not of those in Egyptian language. And the third common feature of the lamp divination spell of PGM 1, 2, and 4 is the final dismissal of the god. The magician performs reversing ritual actions and or offerings plus an invocation which will make the deity leave in a peaceful manner. As I demonstrated with the recitation to the sun god in the morning, an especially interesting field of research are the numerous recitations which usually take up the bulk of the text. They contain prayers, commands, and compulsion formulas to the deities, who are called by diverse names, epithets, and more or less obscure vocis magicae. These spoken parts of the rituals are very fruitful for research, as names or whole passages appear in several spells, often with slight variations. One central recitation in which a great god, who is described with Egyptian and Jewish epithets and vocis magicae, as the Lord and giver of light, is conjured to reveal himself, appears in several lamp divination spells of the Leiden manuscript. In each case, there are minor variations to this invocation, and it is adapted to different circumstances. For instance, in the long and older spell of cluster 1, this is the one on the slide, two alternative options are given in the ritual instructions, either to do the ritual alone or with a boy medium. Therefore, the last part of the invocation, where the final plea to the god to appear is uttered, is parted into two alternatives, one for the magician and one for the boy. In the textual layout, the options for the magician alone are written in smaller script above the respective lines for the boy, with an indentation at the beginning of the lines for the magician alone, because the first words are the same in each case. In the spell directly preceding this one, we find two other alternative options. Either you can see the god directly in the lamplight, or he appears to you in a dream. Therefore, the usual prayer to reveal yourself today is altered to reveal yourself tonight in some passages, since the dream oracle, of course, takes place at night. Furthermore, we can observe the additional input of Jewish traditions in the line, "Reveal yourself to me here today," in the manner of the form of revealing yourself to Moses, which you made upon the mountain, before which you had already created darkness and light. These lines, the allusion to God's revelation to Moses on Mount Sinai, as well as to the creation of darkness and light, have of course been chosen as a mythological reminder to the actual ritual, which works by means of darkness and light, and aims at a divine revelation. The general method of giving a mythological background story and archetype is, however, a very typical Egyptian way of bringing individual private cases to the god's attention. In fact, in order to open a direct channel between human and divine worlds, the object medium of lamp divination practices, the lamp itself, is often addressed in the course of the recitations and asked to act. In the detailed demotic spell from the extensive handbook London-Leiden, the lamp is addressed as a divine agent and is clearly being imagined as a traveler between both worlds. The magician addresses the lamp in order to send it out to find Osiris, the Egyptian god of the underworld and main god of the ritual of this very spell. To fulfill the magician's own demands, that is, to find Osiris, to ask him questions, he connects the lamp with a mythological search for the deceased god Osiris, who, according to Egyptian myth, had drifted away on the Mediterranean Sea to the Syrian coast. His sister and spouse Isis found him there and brought him back to Egypt. This background story of the lamp is further explored in the final part of this recitation, where a mythological precedent is narrated shortly. The last line directly addresses the ritual lamp again and clearly identifies it with the god who helped Isis in the myth. This is certainly an allusion to Isis' mythical search for Osiris again. The whole speech shows that the lamp is thought of as being not only present as a ritual device in the real world, but at the same time transcending the borders to the divine realm, where it is acting and further supposed to act as a reliable messenger. The object used in the ritual is thus given some kind of mythological biography. The ritual use of lamps in the context of communication with the gods is well known from Egyptian as well as Greek cult. The described treatment of the lamp as a living and acting person or deity is, however, especially in accordance with traditional Egyptian ritual texts. The ceremonial lighting of lamps or torches constituted a fixed act within the regular daily offering ritual of the Egyptian temples, and similar rites were conducted on special occasions, such as the New Year's Day, or included in funerary rites and literature. Interestingly, the torch is equated with the eye of Horus, or the so-called Ujjat eye in these spells. The Ujjat eye. And this Ujjat eye also plays a role in three of the lamp divination spells of the London-Leiden papyrus, where it appears as a sign to be written on the wick of the lamp. And in the end of this long spell from the Demotic manuscript, the invoked god is even called the pupil of the eye of the Ujjat. For instance, in an Egyptian New Year's ritual seen in Karnak, a temple in Thebes, the New Year's torch is presented to Amun-Ra with a recitation addressed directly to the torch itself. Hail to thee, this beautiful torch for Amun-Re, lord of the thrones of the two lands. Hail to thee, O eye of Horus, which leads on the road of darkness. The torch is gracious for Amun, lord of the thrones of the two lands, of new fat and cloth of the launderers, as a gift to thee. There are certain elements in these rituals that still have counterparts in the lamp practices of the magical papyri of the late Roman period, especially the emphasized contrast of light and darkness, and the explicit material specifications for the actually burning parts, namely fat and cloth, corresponding to the different types of oil and wick that are described in the later practices. Within the New Kingdom daily offering ritual of the temples, the church is furthermore connected to the realm of the dead, as expressed in the words, the Ujjat eye may enter the western desert. Here the Ujjat eye designates the torch itself, and the west is the typical Egyptian sphere of the dead. The lamp's reach into netherworldly affairs is also affirmed by the use of lamps or torches during the funerary vigil held for Osiris. In the wall decoration of the tomb of Parshet in Deir el-Medina, also in Thebes, this is on the slide, a lamp with two wicks is held before Osiris by a genius, and another identical lamp is held by, again, an eye of Horus or Ujjat eye behind him, while the deceased is squatting beneath it. In other Theban tombs of the New Kingdom, the deceased's ideal bark journey to the west or to Abydos is depicted, showing a lamp set up in the bark as well. This whole scenario is very evocative of the recitation addressed to the lamp in the long spell from the Demotic handbook, where it is closely linked to barks of Amun-Ra and Osiris. This is the middle part of this recitation. Thus, the light of the lamp is supposed in both groups to serve as helper and protector for those passing from one realm to the other, a function which could be ascribed to the lamp divination rituals of the magical papyri as well. My final example of adaptation and development of elements finally concerns the level of single names and epithets. Here we can observe a process of translation, alteration, and very often final disintegration and mystification of originally meaningful divine names. For instance, in the Greek lamp divination spell of PGM4 on your handout, the solar deity Horus Hippocrates is called God of Gods in Greek language, Theeteon, in several instances. The same epithet recurs, this time for Apollo, in a Greek dream oracle where also a lamp is used. And it is used in many other Greek language spells for several deities of superior and mostly solar character. Apart from the magical texts from Egypt, this form of addressing the deity is not conventional in Greek, but the Egyptian equivalent, Panecha na Necharu, is quite frequently attested as a divine epithet from the epoch of the New Kingdom, the second half of the second millennium BC onwards, especially for solar and creator gods again. In most cases, the context of this epithet in the Greek language spells has a strong Egyptian background as well. Additionally, we can also find the Egyptian version, Panecha na Necharu, in the shape of a vox magica, written in Greek letters as Pnute Nenter, in at least four more Greek spells, all of them attributing the sun god again. Therefore, we find different modes of transfer of such a formula from one language into the other. In some cases, it has been translated into the Greek Theeteon, in others, it has been absorbed as a magical word in its original form. But at least after a while, probably without understanding of its meaning by the final user, which might have led to an increased perception of a mysterious character of the texts in question and the magical language used in their recitations. To conclude, I have shown only a few examples for the ways in which we can gain a better understanding of the divination rituals and recitations in the Roman magical handbooks. By comparing them with each other and with older as well as contemporary texts and other material from the contributing cultural traditions. When analyzing and comparing all the extant spells of each divination technique, it is in fact often possible to draw up a tentative stemma of the pertaining spells, to trace back their diverse influences, and to explain, at least in some cases, how they have converged. A close observation of the described ritual techniques and recitations demonstrates that the main focus of the divination rituals in the magical papyri was the establishment of a ritual environment in which an encounter with the divine world and its higher beings was made possible. This was obtained through various strategies that can often be traced back to traditional rituals in which a direct contact with the divine was sought. Within the known attestations of the genre of lamp divination, these traditions mostly seem to derive from Egyptian religion and temple cult. However, there are also the two examples of Greek-type rituals that seem to rely on ritual practice in Greek Apollo sanctuaries with oracle functions. Thank you very much.